swim or cry, then we will realize, but much too late, to undo our ship.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with RED. That is the United Nations program to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from deforestation and degradation. RED started with great promise, but as Amy Moas, a senior forest campaigner for Greenpeace in Indonesia, tells Steve Kerwood, that very little progress has actually been made. And then on to the best hope for a sustainable future on Earth. Alan Weissman talked about the impact of human population on the environment and infrastructure. Alan tells us the good news from Iran. In 1987, a month after its bloody conflict with Iraq ended, the Ayatollah Khomeini ordered the development of what Alan calls the best voluntary family planning program in the world. It has since cut the average family size from 8 children to fewer than 2. Alan's cogent and forthright global inquiry shows how education, women's equality, and family planning can curb poverty, thirst, hunger, and environmental destruction. Alan makes a strong case for slowing global population growth as a prerequisite for achieving a sustainable future.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. Our team found many obstacles to forest protection in Indonesia in 2009, and 4 years, you might think, is long enough for the UN's RED project to make a dent in the rate and extent of deforestation. But Indonesia's climate agency chief, Agus Purnomo, sounded a note of caution to our team at the time. He pointed out that much of the remaining forest in Indonesia could be lost in the single term of an elected official.
If REDD is going to take 7 to 8 years to produce revenues, forget about it. No elected official will be interested. Now, are there bad people? No, they are not bad. But they have to make the most of their terms. And if there's no money going to come in until 7 years from now, why should they worry about it?
So to find out how much of Indonesia's forest RED has actually succeeded in protecting, we called up Amy Moas. She's worked extensively in Indonesia as a senior forest campaigner for Greenpeace. Welcome to Living on Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Now tell us, generally worldwide, how well is RED working when it comes to protecting forests?
The progress with RED has been incredibly slow. While there is a general consensus within the international community that this is a good idea to reduce emissions from deforestation, we have not yet practically figured out how to create a program that will see real carbon emissions and protection of forests on the ground.
How much is this related to the fact we don't have a comprehensive climate deal for the planet?
It is closely related. Some of the key difficulties are happening at the international climate negotiations, and some of the obstacles include how to actually monitor and verify the real carbon emission reductions, and also, where's the money going to come from?
Now, how successful has RED been in Indonesia as a mechanism to protect forests and peatland?
Unfortunately, it has not yet been successful. The Kampar Peninsula in particular is a critical landscape because of its high carbon-rich soils, but RED has not yet been seen to be effective in protecting that area. April, a pulp and paper company, once proposed an idea to protect the Kampar Peninsula using RED. Unfortunately, it has not gotten off the ground, and we've actually seen April doing the complete opposite. April is destroying hundreds of thousands of acres of natural rainforest, including destroying an area with high conservation value inside that Kampar Peninsula.
What's been the response of the national government in Indonesia?
The national government of Indonesia is quite supportive of the idea of RED. Unfortunately, most of the forest management decisions are made more at the district and local level, and it is here where there's very little knowledge of what RED will actually look like in practice. And it's also at this level where we are more concerned about the possibility of corruption.
A few years ago, the president of Indonesia imposed a moratorium for no more additional clearance of forests. But what's happened here?
Yeah, that's right. So in 2011, the president of Indonesia established a forest moratorium. It was also extended just recently, again in 2013. And what this means is that the government of Indonesia will not grant any new forest concessions to extractive industries, to pulp and paper companies, or to palm oil companies. A lot of these companies and industries still hold vast amounts of concessions of undeveloped land. So the rate of deforestation has not really decreased.
Amy, just how fast is deforestation proceeding in Indonesia at this point?
There was a recent study that said 80% of the island of Borneo has been deforested. That number is both shocking and true. Only about 20% of the original primary forests remain standing. If you look at just Indonesia alone, the number is about 25%, so a little bit better. But the remaining forests are in very remote areas, including the islands of Sulawesi and Papua. So the islands of Sumatra and Borneo have been almost completely decimated. Now, these numbers are driven largely by the expansion of pulp and paper companies and palm oil companies, as well as some other extractive industries.
In the first half of the documentary, we heard about how paper companies and the promise of RED were impacting rural communities in Indonesia. What do you think is going on in those areas now?
The local communities are the ones that are most impacted when these extractive industries or pulp and paper companies and palm oil companies are allowed to go in and clear cut the forest. Palm oil is the number one driver of deforestation right now in Indonesia, and there has been extensive documentation of human rights abuses and labor abuses in these local communities. So while RED was once proposed as an alternative to this forest destruction and to these abuses, it hasn't yet really become operational. The local communities aren't seeing the benefits just yet.
On the whole, Amy, what kind of hope can you offer here? How optimistic are you that RED might still be a viable way to protect the world's rainforest and Indonesia's forest specifically?
Yeah, RED definitely has the potential to change the way that forests are managed and present an opportunity for forests to remain standing. Unfortunately, we are still a ways away from that. The fundamental difficulties in actually creating a program that can monitor the carbon emissions and create an incentive to leave the forest standing, it seems like we're still a ways off. But we do still have hope that we can find an alternative. Greenpeace firmly believes that we need both political solutions like RED, but also market-based solutions, working with companies to improve their operations and protect forests that way.
Amy Moss is a senior forest campaigner for Greenpeace. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you.
Tune in in to Great Speeches and Interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays on Access Sacramento, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. See the big picture on financial, military, environmental crises, war and peace, the economy, and climate change are covered. And then there's music and humor. Challenge your thinking with Great Speeches and Interviews from 6 to 8 p.m. on Sundays, or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come and saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. On the run in the 1970s. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s. I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
Sustainable future on Earth. Alan shows how education, women's equality, and family planning can curb poverty, thirst, hunger, and environmental destruction. Alan makes a strong case for slowing global population growth as a prerequisite for achieving a sustainable future.
Basically, we are so lucky to have with us today Alan Wiseman, who's an international journalist and author. who's written for New York Times Magazine, Orion, Mother Jones, Discover, the best science writing of 2006. And besides some of his award-winning articles, he's also won awards for several of his previous books, including Gaviotas, A Village to Reinvent the World, and The World Without Us, which was named Top Nonfiction Book of the Year by Entertainment Weekly and Time Magazine, among others. And so a lot of you probably know him from that. And Alan, I have to say that your book, The World Without Us, was one of the most inspiring things that I've ever read. You had people benignly disappear and then described how the cities and farms and rivers and mountain lions would soon revert back to a more natural state. That book was translated into 34 languages, which means a lot of people found it inspiring. And Countdown already has been translated. It's coming out with 15 foreign editions and more in the way. So it's another top seller around the world, which is no wonder since you visited 21 countries to produce it. So basically, given your past success with World Without Us and what you learned on that, I'm sure a lot of us are wondering what inspired you to write Countdown.
Thanks. Hey, thank you all for coming. This is really nice. Some of you do know The World Without Us. For those of you who don't, just suffice it to say that I wrote that book because I really want a world with us. The idea of, as she said, benignly removing a species to which we are all intimately involved, was to show how, when relieved of the daily pressures that we heap on the planet, the Earth rebounds in surprisingly swift and wonderful ways, eventually even refills empty niches that we have inadvertently extinguished their residence. My hope was that people would see this restored Earth and wonder, okay, is there any way that we can add ourselves back into this picture, only this time in nice harmony and balance with the rest of nature, not in mortal combat with it? And so the epilogue for that book was intended to be just a little discussion about how we might do that. But I ran into a rather disturbing fact, and that is that, you know, you see these figures on population, and they're so big you can't get your mind around them, but thanks to the invention of the calculator, I did some long division by 365, and I found out that basically every 4 to 4.5 days, we add 1 million people to the planet. And this is not a sustainable number. So at the end of that book, I did this other little thought experiment, which I hadn't even planned on. I asked a demographics institute in Vienna, which is one of the premier such organizations, what would happen if, setting aside all social concerns, everyone participated in the Chinese policy from then on, and we only had one child per family. And it turns out that, you know, instead our numbers go like this, suddenly they would go like this, and by the end of this century, we'd be back at about 1.6 billion, which was exactly the population of the Earth in 1900, before our population suddenly doubled and then doubled again. We quadrupled in one century for reasons I'm sure we're going to get into. So I sort of left that dangling at the end of The World Without Us. The idea of, wow, how many of us is a safe population on this planet, and is this something that we should be talking about when we talk about how to deal with environmental concerns? And I expected a lot of blowback. Instead, what I got was just an onrush of interest from a lot of readers. Everyone wanted to talk about this thing, and I was on Catholic radio programs, and I gave talks in Mormon, Utah, and still everybody got the fact that things are more crowded than they were before, and God, all these cities that are endless and all the smog. And finally I decided, well, it's a really important topic, but it's also a really explosive one, and people get really passionate about it because religion and economics, you know, growth, that's what makes it, you know, our economy healthy. There's a lot of stuff tangled up in there. So I decided someone should really explore this topic, not as pro-population control. I mean, that itself is a loaded word, so we say population management, or anti. Explore it as a journalist does. You know, really research this thing and try to find out, can we determine how many people the Earth can safely hold without tipping it over? The converse of that, can we figure out how much nature we need to preserve, because we're getting so numerous, we're starting to push other stuff off the planet at an increasing pace. And at a certain point, we're going to push something off we won't realize until it's too late that, oops, we should have kept that one. Given that, what comes to mind, everybody's mind, is that Chinese one-child policy, and nobody likes it, including the Chinese. Are there other approaches? Is there anything in the histories, the liturgies, or the current experiences of the world's vast swath of cultures that might embrace the idea of, so to speak, refraining from embracing so much in a time of urgency? And then last, you know, the one about economics, like, can we, if we have to stop growing or even shrink to a sustainable size, is there a way to design an economy that will allow us to prosper without constant growth? So particularly that third question, the one about all the cultures, et cetera, that's why I ended up going to 21 countries for this book. I started in Israel and Palestine, and I ended in Iran.
All good stuff, and many of these topics that you mentioned in passing we'll want to come back and delve into. And I also did want to let you know we're going to leave some time for questions from the audience toward the end, so if you have any, you can think of them. But let's start out, not everyone actually even considers population a problem, and given all the other problems that are vying for attention, you know, why do you consider it a serious problem, and how does it rank among the others?
Well, I think it's the problem that underlies all the problems. We wouldn't have environmental problems if one species hadn't grown suddenly so numerous. I mean, we are basically in the most abnormal growth spurt of any population in the history of biology. And we don't really notice it that much because we all were born in the middle of it, and it looks kind of normal to us.
If we can't communicate to people, we're not going to be able to reach them. And this is about that. About what they're not telling us, why we need shows like Democracy Now. You'd think I'm really trying to ingratiate myself with the staff of Democracy Now, but, and it's true, but. The CIA is pushing crack in the ghettos of L.A. while the food crops in Colombia get sprayed by the DEA. The FBI is reading your email with something called a carnivore. While the rich are getting richer and the poor are staying poor, they're launching nuclear-powered ships up into space. One little accident could wipe out half the human race. They're putting radioactive waste into your silverware, or maybe your toaster, or perhaps your wheelchair. The Air Force is bombing Iraq every other day. They don't like the government, so the children have to pay. And the ozone hole is growing, the sheep are going blind, while the U.S. spends more on arms than the rest of the world combined. Journalists are getting fired from San Jose to Atlanta when they write about reality, not a fluff piece for Fanta. A death threat every week, and sometimes life is short when the truth is too dangerous for someone to report. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? The cancer rates are skyrocketing, though people are smoking less. If you live near a nuke, your life is bound to be a mess. Clean water's almost gone all over the earth, and what's left they want to privatize and see how much it's worth. Chevron is gunning down the students of Nigeria, turning the land to waste while the babies die of diphtheria. And the temperatures are rising, the world's forests are on fire. Pretty soon Brazil will be one raging funeral pyre. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? Thank you. One in three adult Americans cannot read or write, and their children go to bed hungry every night. 2 million U.S. citizens are rotting behind bars, and while they're there, they're working hard building parts for cars. The Army's running torture schools to keep the earth under control, and they're relocating Navajos so they can mine some extra coal. Our taxes pay McDonald's to sell tumors in Shanghai, while 100,000 poisoned vets are just about to die. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? And the people are resisting wherever you may go. And this is the single biggest fact they don't want you to know. From New Delhi to New Mexico, there are battles going on. And the darkest hour is just before the dawn. In Berkeley and New York, they're raiding radio stations, trying to turn the voice of the people into the voice of the corporations. Will we seize the airwaves, wipe the sweat off of our brow, stand and face the beast and shout democracy now? Who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? That we're living in these times? That we're living in these times.
But now for something completely different.